Okay, we are back again, and it's Saturday the 4th of November 2017. This is the Crass Files podcast with Adam, and everything's up on the website, so go over there, crassfiles.com, C-R-A-Z-Z, links to social media as well. You can also get the podcast over on iTunes, if you'd like to get it there. Check out opensourcetruth.com as well, but as I said, just go over to the website. I've made it so everything that I put out is up there. Investigative reporter John Rappaport is back again with me today. Great to have you, John. How are you over there in the US?
Okay, doing all right.
Still getting out of the articles. You were just recently on Wednesday US time on Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie doing a big interview there on the deep state, and you've got a new article out today on the deep state trafficking killer opioids. This is something that we touched on many times, but you keep coming back to it, and you've put out some more big articles on this, so you're going full throttle here on the opioid addiction crisis. I guess not just in America, but you're looking elsewhere as well. I haven't had too much of a look here in Australia, but things are pretty grim over there in the US. You want to go through this, you can have the floor on what happened on Norrie,
sure,
and how you did, and let us know about this. It's extremely worrying, to say the least. Yeah,
I think it's, if you looked closely, you would probably find that it's happening in Australia. It's certainly happening in England. And on the show the other night with George Norrie, we had a caller from Canada who said it was happening there, I believe. So, where to start? Well, the thing that I found interesting on the interview the other night on Coast to Coast AM was that, first of all, George was very interested, and so I had a chance. I had a chance to get into a lot of details because we talked for 2 hours or so. And we had nonstop callers when he opened up the phone lines, and people were reporting their experiences and asking questions and so forth. So I had an insider, somebody who has been fighting against the expansion of these dangerous medical drugs for a long time. And we had a conversation, and it was kind of a collaborative conversation because I kept bringing up points and he would confirm them and then he would add to them in certain cases. And a picture emerged. First of all, these drugs like fentanyl, Percocet, Percodan, Demerol, Oxycontin, there are perhaps 100 of these opioids. They are painkillers, and they're prescribed for severe pain, but they're also heavily addicting. And then there is this gigantic illegal trafficking that is going on as well. So there are a couple of different pipelines of supply. The first one that my insider and I explored, I started off by saying to him, I read in a recent article about how there would be a very small pharmacy or a very small medical clinic out in the middle of nowhere in a small town somewhere with very sparse population. And this, small medical clinic would have 1 million opioid pills in their inventory. I said, how is that possible? And he said, well, first of all, you have to understand that they have a doctor or two on site who are writing between, and we settled on a figure somewhere between, say, 50 and 100 prescriptions a day. And he said, then you have people who are showing up who are not from the surrounding area. They're coming from all over the country. They're flying in. And he said, for example, it's documented that in certain cases, you'll see that a person flies in once a month. They have a flight booked every month and they fly in. They buy prescriptions. They get the prescriptions filled. They go home. And then, of course, they distribute, they sell these opioid pills to dealers who then sell them to everybody that they can, to addicts. I said, okay, where does a small pain clinic or pharmacy get their pills from? All these pills. And he said, from a distributor. I said, a distributor, does that mean a legal company? Oh, yeah. These would be companies that distribute medicines to pharmacies. I said, okay, and where do the distributors get their opioid pills? From the manufacturers, from the drug companies. So this is the pipeline. Now, he made it very clear that the agreement between the distributors and the pharmaceutical manufacturers is completely knowing and conscious. They both know that they're trafficking drugs. They're drug traffickers. They're not under the illusion that they're distributing these opioid pills, in this case, to treat any patients who are in severe pain. They know that they're traffickers, and they're addicting people, and they're killing people. 300,000 deaths in America since the year 2000, roughly 33,000 deaths a year now, and it's getting worse. So I said, well, the agency in the United States that would come down hard on these distributors and manufacturers would be the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration, which is organized under the Department of Justice in America, the Attorney General. I said, so why can't the DEA march right into a major pharmaceutical manufacturer and say, look at this gigantic shipment of opioid pills that you are about to send out here. We know where it's going. It can't be for legal use. You're a trafficker, so we're arresting you, and also we're freezing this shipment. And he said, well, what makes it much harder is a law that was passed in 2016 in America and signed by Obama. And it was unanimously passed in both houses of Congress. And he said the overwhelming majority of congressional members had no idea what they were voting on, which of course meant they didn't read the bill. Because the key section was tucked away inside a whole bunch of other stuff. And it redefined what the DEA could and couldn't do to freeze huge shipments of opioid pills that were trafficking. In fact, it made it so hard and complex that the DEA was in a straitjacket at that point and could get involved in all kinds of legal wrangling and postponements and so on and so forth that would keep them from being able to stop these shipments by distributors and manufacturers. And then he went on to explain that one of the key figures in writing the bill that passed Congress used to work for the DEA and was responsible for going up against distributors and manufacturers and trying to limit their trafficking. But then he left the DEA in 2010, 2011, and he started working for the drug industry. And he knew all the weaknesses of the DEA because he had worked there. And so he was able to craft a bill that would put the DEA in a straitjacket. So now we have this law in America, which has helped to increase the volume of trafficking in these opioids. So that's the first pipeline. The second pipeline is through China, underground labs that are making designer spin-offs of some of these drugs, notably fentanyl, an opioid. And the designer drugs are much more powerful than fentanyl, which is already 50 times more powerful than morphine. So these are killer drugs. And the DEA and law enforcement are throwing up their hands in America because they don't know what to do about it. And they're trying to warn people that if you take any of these pills on the street that are sold by a dealer, if they're the designer versions or contaminated by the designer versions, you could die quickly. And according to the DEA, it's most likely that the pills that are coming out of China are coming up through Mexico into the U.S. So that's another pipeline. And then the third, or maybe it's just part of the first two, or maybe coming out of China, it's hard to say. There's a drug called carfentanil, which is an elephant tranquilizer. And when that is being sold as an opioid pill, that's like instant death. Not addiction, you just die. So this is getting completely out of hand. And reading articles from the British press, it's getting out of hand there too. And law enforcement doesn't know what to do about it, really. So what I pointed out in my article today was that, in a sense, people should look at this as part and parcel of the pharmaceutical cartel, because the cartel has been killing people at a very high rate with medical drugs for a very long time. And opioids is just one example of that. And I go back and I point out the same study that I've been citing for years now, about which the government has done nothing, the medical cartel has done nothing, drug companies have done nothing, which was published. It's all mainstream, Journal of the American Medical Association, July 26, 2000. Author Dr. Barbara Starfield, who at the time worked at the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. Everybody's mainstream credentials are meticulous, and her conclusion was that every year in the U.S., the medical system kills 225,000 people and injures millions of others. And of that figure, 106,000 a year are killed by FDA-approved pharmaceutical drugs. So that would be a million plus per decade. And that these drugs are correctly prescribed. It's not an issue of self-medication. It's just business as usual. So these are the people that the delusional and dangerous promoters of vaccines consider to be reputable and above board and indisputable in their science. These are the people that we're supposed to trust when they tell us that vaccines are safe and effective, medical drugs are safe and effective, and everything is just fine. So in a nutshell, that is what I've been writing about the past couple of weeks.
My goodness, it's unbelievable. Unbelievable, isn't it? To say the least. It seems, listening to you there, just sort of looking at some info I have here, it seems that we're on the same path, I did see on the news the other night there, the border police is, blocking these huge shipments from China of this stuff. But it's all these articles here from 2017 seem to be saying the prescription opioid epidemic is coming to Australia. They seem to know. You know, I don't think that anything's without reason. I mean, it's coming right. for a reason. I mean, there's people behind it, you know. But there, yeah, some recovering heroin addicts said on the streets of Sydney that it was easier to get than almost anything, that it's everywhere there. So we obviously have that big problem here. They're saying it's rampant. So in the last 10 years, it's got out of control there. They're saying here in the US about 142 people die every day from accidental overdoses, and about 60,000 people died last year, more than the Vietnam War. So it's incredible. And I pulled up another new article from the UK saying the killer synthetic opioid drugs like fentanyl, which you were just talking about, are heading to Australia. Saying the border force officials are trying to crack down on it, but it's being sold through the dark web and coming from China, according to this. So buyers are going onto this dark web and and getting this, and it's being shipped in packets. They're saying there was maybe a ban on it in China, so it's gone under the prohibited the manufacturing of it, so it's gone underground, I would say. But this is very dodgy, John, to say the least, because you were talking about there this mix of the stuff coming from China and then going up through Mexico. That's incredible into the US, and we've got it coming in here. I mean, we're an island. They're shipping it in. I mean, there's big money behind this, obviously, and forces behind this, and you're of course exposing the pharmaceutical companies as a cartel, which they are. They're drug traffickers. That's what they've always been. But yeah, just to answer you from what you were asking before, yeah, it looks like we are in serious trouble in Australia. Indeed, looks like not like the US as yet, but it's coming. Big time.
And you know, the way that I look at this is, let's say that when you take these pills, that the grains of powder that they're made out of is white powder. So how are you going to tell what's mixed in? If it's some of the designer opioids coming out of China, if it's the elephant tranquilizer, if it's the standard fentanyl, you know. Because by the time it gets mixed and matched and so forth, there's no way to know. The dealers don't know. The dealers that are trafficking on the streets, they don't necessarily know what they're selling. So, and then you've got, you know, the drug companies themselves that are pushing these drugs. We had a case of Purdue Pharmaceuticals, I think it was last year in America, the Sackler family, very prestigious family that, you know, at the top of Purdue Pharmaceuticals. So they were busted, the drug company, for OxyContin, which is one of the major opioids, for, you know, bribery, fraud, paying doctors and researchers or convincing doctors and researchers to prescribe the drug, to overprescribe it, to pretend that there were no real dangers, significant dangers of addiction, that the drug could be used long-term, which is, of course, now we're talking about causing addiction, et cetera, et cetera. You know, total fraud, deceit. The revenue from OxyContin to Purdue Pharma, $35 billion. They were prosecuted. The verdict was they had to pay a fine of $600 million. And three or four executives that were actually convicted were sentenced to 400 hours of community service. That's it. So you can see what the attitude of the government is toward these criminals. I mean, if you or I were behind a scheme like this, you know, we would get 50 years in jail at the minimum. So there's a kind of a nudge, nudge, wink, wink relationship between the pharmaceutical companies and the Department of Justice, the law enforcement, the court system, et cetera, et cetera.
Hmm. Yeah. Oh, man, it's just, yeah, it's quite incredible, isn't it? Looking at the stats for the U.S., you guys are blown out of the ballpark for the use of this stuff.
Yeah, so here's another
Canada
another
as
stat.
Well, of course. I think Australia look about eighth in the rankings there of using this and climbing. But the U.S. is most of the countries like Canada, Germany, you know, Belgium, Austria, Switzerland. It's all these countries are pretty even, but the U.S. is more than double any of these other countries. So,
right.
So many Americans are in pain, John. Nearly 40%
yeah,
40%
well,
are in pain.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you about how that works. Because a recent CBS News survey, or a survey that they quoted, you know, these surveys are a little questionable, but you get sort of a general picture, said that in the year 2015, 90 million adults in America received a prescription opioid. 90 million. And that doesn't even count the illegal trafficking. Well, there aren't 90 million American adults that are in severe pain, believe me. I mean, in order to need an opioid that is stronger than morphine, for example, legitimately need it, you would have to be in agonizing pain.
The cancer sufferers, stuff like that.
Yeah. Hmm. Or, you know, you just had spinal surgery or something like that, you know. So, you know, it's not even close. I mean, it isn't as if there are 90 million adults walking around in America in severe agonizing pain. So there's a total population of whatever it is now, 310, 320 million people in America, men, women, and children. And yet we have 90 million adults that received an opioid in the year, a prescribed opioid from a doctor in the year 2015. Jeez. I mean, we're talking about an incredible amount of addiction here and the destruction of the country from the inside. That's the point of all of this. Mm. When you finally get down to the deepest or highest level of this whole cartel operation is destruction. That's what it's constructed to do.
It is.
Because if you've got enough people that are debilitated and addicted and they can't function and they're dying, and you've got a population that is very easy to control.
Yeah, jeez. Seems.
And in Australia, what have you got, like 25 million people?
Yeah, that's
so
what I'm saying. It seems
it's
to be
very different. Easy to target that population.
Yeah. It seems to be a war against a new kind of war against the white working middle to higher class, because this is different. It's not like, you know, your average kind of drug addicts that you're used to, heroin and stuff like that. I mean, this is just general everyday people and families and everything that are going down with this stuff. We also have a terrible ice epidemic here. So all sorts of people are taking this, but you've got this opioid use of all these people. This is terrible. You got these people addicted to this. As you said there, yeah, I mean, you obviously got addicts, and you've got, as you said, an amount of people who are actually really in pain who need it. But you've got the larger number who are just everyday people, I think, who are addicted to this stuff. This is going to bring in pretty scary consequences, I would say. Because I don't think the Western nations, you know, America, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, I think we've dealt with anything like this before. And if this gets worse, which it seems to be, this is a new terror, believe me. Yeah, it's quite unbelievable to look at those kind of
stuff. It is. You know? It is, yeah.
Everyday mums and dads, I guess, even school kids and children.
Sure.
People, you know, just needing those opioids, John, to get up and go to work.
It gets into all classes of people. I mean, nobody's exempt. And then on top of that, take, for example, Valium, which is another one of the most widespread drugs used in the world, tranquilizer. So this is sedating, tranquilizing entire populations. And I had a reader get back to me who lives in Ohio after I wrote my first article on the opioid epidemic a while back. And he said, in his city, he can see it on the streets, people walking around like zombies that are totally, you know, out there on these drugs. They start off because it's a very powerful high. Feel relaxed, feel, you know, a sense of well-being, everything's great. Then you keep going, and you keep going, and of course, like any other drug, you build up a tolerance, so you need more. And then if for any reason you're cut off, which happens, then what happens? People start to look for heroin. So these drugs are now a new gateway drug into heroin. And of course, with heroin, traditionally, it can be cut and contaminated with God knows what by the time it reaches the street. And some of these compounds that it's cut with are incredibly toxic. So sometimes the overdose is not just heroin, it's whatever is in the heroin. So that is now accounting for a huge number of new heroin addicts that would never have reached for that drug before. So, you know, people who talk about legalizing drugs and ending the drug war, on one level, I agree with them because when you look at the consequences of making all these drugs illegal, then of course you see cartels and black markets and huge profits and killings with rival cartels and gangs and so forth. But on the other hand, when the drugs are literally poisons, as these are, then you're talking about legalizing poison. Well, I mean, would you want to legalize arsenic and say, you know, everybody's on their own? So this is what the country is faced with. And many countries are now faced with, as you say. You know. And it is reaching into new segments of the population that weren't being targeted before. And like any business operation, it's always looking for new markets. So children are going to be the new market. They already are. And what has to happen is that, at least in America, this law that is putting the DEA in a straitjacket has to be repealed. And then the DEA has to go after these pharmaceutical companies, hammer and tong, bring them into court on racketeering and homicide, you know, you name it, and give the executives 20 to 50 years in prison with no chance of parole. Then you would start to see some changes made.
Murderers. It's unbelievable. Oh, my goodness. Yeah, they're murderers.
Right.
As you said before, what happened? You know, we went out and murdered someone, you know? I mean, you don't pay a parking ticket, they want to put you in prison. I mean,
right. You don't get 400 hours of community service. You know, you get 50 years in jail and not in a country club.
Yeah, big pharma murderers. sort of looking at the brain and these opioids, you know, it's saying how opioids trigger pleasurable chemicals in the brain. So, you know, the brain associates the action of taking the opioid with a, you know, a pleasurable reward or event. And so it starts to become wired to do this. And you start people maybe one or two of these drugs, these little white pills, as you said, a day, and then it can go on to more, you know, four or five or whatever they have. And then you start looking into the withdrawal and the symptoms on the body overdoses and lethal sort of side effects of this stuff. It's pretty unbelievable looking into it, you know, when you're just looking at a little pill that you put in your mouth, you know, and swallow with some water. I guess in, you know, I've never had anything to do with these. I know in the retirement homes, because I know with my, you know, my own grandma, you know, they had her on morphine and stuff. They do that to the elderly, you know. Instead of having proper care for elderly who are nearing death, the point of death, and they recognize that they are nearing the point of death because they might start seeing things or talking to people that aren't there or whatever it is, and the nurses do recognize them, and they have them on this morphine, and then we've talked about this many times, that there's not this care anymore for people who are dying, and they're just shoving this morphine and things in drugs into them, and they're passing like that, which is absolutely despicable. And I can understand if people seriously need this stuff and they're in pain, but, you know, looking at all this, unbelievable, and I'm wondering the average person, the journey they would be on here, how would they go through this, John, you know, an average sort of person who's maybe got a family and having trouble and is stressed or whatever, then maybe not in so much pain, but they start off on this and then slowly become addicted. Are we looking at a downward spiral here of that person? Mm. Is that what it's doing in the US? I mean, is it taking ordinary people and just putting them down, and now they're losing their jobs and families? Mm-hmm. Are they becoming violent, or are they just becoming zombies?
Well, I think they're mostly becoming zombies, but if you're talking about then being cut off the withdrawal symptoms, you could get all kinds of violent behavior.
That's right.
Basically, what the addict tries to do is cover up their addiction, unless they're just a street addict who is wandering the streets all the time. So what you've got is, let's say a person has a family, a job, and so forth, and they slowly get addicted where they're taking more and more and they're becoming less functional. So they're going to try to hide this from other family members. And they're going to do whatever they can and spend as much money as they need to, right, in order to get these drugs. And the family is going to watch their behavior deteriorate and not know what to do. Mm. And it's going to get worse and worse and worse until hopefully somebody recognizes what's going on. But even then, what's the, you know, what is the remedy for this? Well, first of all, the person has to be willing, the addict, to recover. And, you know, if they go to rehab, I don't know what they're doing these days, but I mean, they can get whatever the drugs are that are currently in their system they can remove them, but then what? What about the craving? What about the withdrawal? There are certain drugs that they can give them that, you know, sort of help, I suppose, although, for example, methadone, which is one of those drugs, is itself an opioid. So what are you really doing there? And this is one of the reasons why you see a gigantic movement toward natural health, because the more responsible people who are addicted, many of them, realize that they have to revolutionize their own lives completely. And that provokes a strong motivation and strong energy in the direction away from addiction. So they change their diet, and they do it. They exercise, and they perhaps they meditate, and you know, they take supplements, and they do everything possible to change their lives for the better. And then, of course, you've got the pharmaceutical cartel and their slaves in the media, and the doctors and the medical experts who come down hard on the natural health movement and say it's all preposterous, meaningless, and it's just a placebo effect, and organic food is no better than food that's been sprayed with chemicals. And, you know, so they are attacking the very means by which individuals can change their lives and stop being addicts. And so they're trying to lock the door on these untold millions and millions of people who are suffering addiction. It's, I mean, it's unconscionable from every angle you can imagine.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, the natural health movement keeps growing because people are recognizing that they're being lied to every day in every way by the medical cartel and the pharmaceutical companies. And so they are taking their health in their own hands. But the movement has to become much bigger and much more vocal. And I think we may have touched on a period in my life in the early 1990s when I was very much involved in the so-called health freedom movement in America. But in that case, the people who were putting the money behind it were really only interested in causing enough protest in order to get a bill passed by Congress that would protect nutritional supplement manufacturers from having their products taken away by the government. Which, okay, they achieved a partial victory in 1994 because that bill did pass. But then the funding went away. The nutritional supplement companies went home. They forgot all about it. And the wider health freedom movement did not move beyond that as a movement when it should have. It should have gone hammer and tongs after the FDA, after the medical cartel, after the pharmaceutical companies, the whole thing, and in favor of natural health. But it didn't happen, and it needs to happen on every front. Every front.
Mm. Yeah.
There was, for example, a movement in the United States, which was well documented by a reporter friend of mine at the time in the, let's call it the mid-1990s. The National Institutes of Health, which is the biggest medical research facility in the world, is a government agency under the executive branch. Gigantic. And they decided that they would create what they called a section of complementary medicine, which was supposed to do studies and research on different natural health modalities to see how effective they really could be, you know, massage, acupuncture, whatever, you know. But a few of us at the time saw that this was just a con. What they were really trying to do was to co-opt and take over part or as much of the so-called holistic medical community as they could by giving a few people cushy research grants and jobs and patting them on the head and saying, you're a good boy, and we think you're doing something important, and, you know, blah, 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 and making sort of vague promises and suggestions that maybe one day chiropractic would be listed alongside of conventional medicine and acupuncture and naturopathy, blah, 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 sucked in a whole lot of people and weakened the health freedom movement. So that's one of their strategies for actually taking over the field.
Mm. Yeah, bringing it down. Mm-hmm. That's what they're doing here in Australia. We have a big natural therapies here in Australia, and I mean, it's, you know, a lot of people use it, just from general health food stores and markets right through, you know, homeopathy, naturopathy, all this, herbologists, you know, of course with China, you know, I mean, they're attacking Chinese medicine here in Australia. That takes, you could have big balls for that. You know, there's these science skeptic groups that seem to be working with the big pharma in many ways, are trying to take this down. And there's been some scary laws being brought in regards to that. So there's a big tag. They're attacking vitamin supplements now.
Sure.
You know, and all of this sort of stuff in Australia. But I think it's just making it like the vaccine thing. It's making it worse and worse. And now they're starting to lash out, but to try and... I mean, I think, you know, you would have 10 million Australians, I mean, more than half the country, using vitamin supplements in some way, whether it's, you know, things like glucosamine, fish oils, vitamin D, vitamin C supplements, multivites, whatever it is. And if there's people out there that say that they don't work or whatever it may be, then that's their opinion. But, you know, if people feel better about taking this, it's not hurting them. But there is a very nasty, grubby war on, you know, I use homeopathy. We used homeoprophylaxis, which is a form of vaccination for our daughter, and she's been fine on that. And I have many friends who've used that, and they've been fine. They haven't had anything. So I've used it for my own health here and there, the homeopathy. You know, I had an extreme chest infection a couple of years ago. I could not get rid of it. I just couldn't get rid of it. Went on nearly for a month, and I tried everything, and I saw my homeopath and went in there and gave me a preparation. In 2 days, I was cleared.
Wow.
And better on the third day, much, much better. The next morning, I was much better. So if she just handed me sugar tablets, like the trolls want you to believe, then, you know, I'll take the sugar tablets over the big pharma drugs. But it's something I've personally used for a long time, and many people prefer to go down that path and use that for themselves and their families, and that's their damn choice, you know. But we have a Prime Exactly. Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, that honestly acts and looks like a slick big pharmaceutical salesman, you know. He's up there selling the new Gardasil 9 now, and you know, because he's got direct shares, him and his wife, in Big Pharma, you know, as well. And he's up there, he looks like a salesman for Big Pharma, selling the drugs for him, you know. And he's over there in Israel now with Benjamin Netanyahu, talking about how Australia and Israel are shining beacons of light for democracy, and how Australian people are so free, they can do whatever they want. He's an absolute liar. He's a con man, that's what he is. And everyone's seeing that now. And I think, as I said before, you know, forcing the vaccine issue as much as they have here, it's opened up a can of worms, to say the least. And it's spilling over the edges now. And now with the attack on what people can take, you know, looking at things like vitamins and minerals, and attacking, as you were talking about before, the... the health industry, you know, whether it be things like massage or, you know, yoga and all of this, they're attacking this as well. And all these kind of therapies, people like to go and see their naturopath or whatever, that's their right, or they like to take Chinese medicine. There's these ugly, nasty, vindictive attacks now through the media and stuff on all of this. You know, but they're not saying anything about these opioids and all these problems we're having. That's all fine for them, you know. But I think attacking these things is just going to make people want it more and more suspicious. That's what I'm sort of seeing. Families, I sent you some articles in New Zealand. The vaccine rates are dropping now because of the movie Vaxxed. And they're banning these people from coming here and talking. You know, they're just desperate. And the media are lashing out. But people are seeing this movie and... you know, I saw a documentary the other night I sent to you from the U.S. I think it's Louis Theroux. You know, then they're looking at the families living with autism. It was called Extreme Love.
And, oh, yeah.
He was in the houses of all these autistic kids, and they never talk about why they're autistic. It's always
yeah, right.
about just how to manage it, and they just are. But the autistic epidemic in America and what these parents have to put up with, and some of these kids are big and they're violent. One of the mums had to put boxing gloves on this boy who was beating her up, and all of this. Some of them have to go to special homes at night because they can't have them at home. They don't trust their own kids. And I just thought, this is so terrible, what's happening to our children through these drugs, vaccines, what they're doing to the human population is so horrendous. And then you add in this opioid addiction as well, and you add it in with everything on top, and this kind of zombification of the human race. You wonder what we're going to be left with in the next decade or so, you know? It's quite scary. And as you said, you know, if their drugs get taken away, they could turn violent. To get them. I'm wondering
sure.
what's going to happen here as well, of course. You know, are we going to see
and
the
not
same
just,
kind of system as
not
the
just a violent because they're taken away, but because the withdrawal symptoms of not having those chemicals once you're addicted, those symptoms can be very violent. So it isn't just you're violent because now you need to get the drugs and you'll do anything to get them, but coming off of it, because, you know, let's say somebody's been addicted for a year to these opioids, and then they can't get them anymore, and they can't get anything. So now they're thrown into sudden withdrawal, not sensible, gradual lowering of the dose over a period of time, you know, and supplementing with good nutrition, etc. It's none of that. It's just like all of a sudden. Well, that sets up all kinds of horrendous reactions, internal reactions, that in some cases or in many cases can be worse than the behavior exhibited by the addict when he's on the drug. So, yeah, you see, in the case of opioids, what you're essentially doing is tranquilizing and sedating the population beyond their ability to rebel, to say something horrible is going on here and we have to stop it, because they're in a state where they're below the level of being able to take action because they're just drugged out and they're on these drugs that, you know, literally suppress and slow down body function. That's what they do.
And the immune system.
Yeah, over a period of time, absolutely. I mean, I've emphasized this point several times. I don't know how many people get it, but I'll keep emphasizing it anyway. As far as people who are in authentic, severe, agonizing pain, you've got morphine, which has been around, I think, since 1800 or so. You could have, let's say, two or three other more powerful painkillers. That's all you need. That's all you need medically. You don't need 100 different opioids, pharmaceutical opioids. And because you've got all of these other opioids, these are the pills that are fueling the illegal trafficking and the epidemic and the addiction, because you can't control it. There's too many. So there's absolutely no reason for there to be Percodan and Percocet and Demerol and OxyContin and fentanyl and this and that and blah, 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 blah. I mean, as I said with George Nuri the other night, I started looking at lists of pharmaceutical opioid drugs and stopped counting when I got to 50. There's maybe 100 of these things. Some of them in combination with other drugs, some of them standalones. Well, what the hell is going on? I mean, why? Well, because on one level, the drug company thinks they can make money by, you know, running studies on some new opioid and claiming that it has a unique action, whatever. But really, at the highest level, it's just another tool to sedate and hypnotize the population.
Yeah, God. Jeez, I don't need any more of that. The entertainment industry and the TV to do that.
Yeah, really. Why do we need any more of that, right?
In the phone.
Already
yeah,
got
the
plenty of that.
It's a huge spider's web. Yeah, it's all encompassing, isn't it? It's everywhere. It's all around. It's all this well-oiled machine taking humanity down. It's unbelievable. My goodness. We've got a couple of minutes left, but looking at your latest article, which I'll attach to the podcast today, the podcast will be named that, and I'll attach it there, the Deep State Trafficking Killer Opioids. You talk about here in July 26, 2000, about the landmark review published in the Journal of American Medical Association, just to go over again, but how it's amazing these pharmaceutical companies, you say they're partners, the FDA, many members of Congress, medical schools, doctors, they've all been aware of these approved medical drugs that have been killing and maiming people in America. And you say here it's a disastrous rate. These drugs by Big Pharma kill 106,000 Americans a year. Like clockwork. That's an important thing you say there, like clockwork. Because this is, as I said, a well-oiled machine going around here, churning around. And this equals over a million deaths per decade. This is unbelievable, and we've got Prince William over there saying that the world is too populated while he's expecting another royal baby. You know, Prince William thinks it's too many of us. You know, maybe if we're going to have a culling, we should start with the royals. But this is unbelievable, isn't it? You know, you got all these prestigious people and these doctors and these medical schools and Congress and politicians and FDA and all these pharmaceutical giants, all completely conscious and aware that this is, this is killing massive amounts of people in this horrifying manner, and no one's doing anything about it, you know. It's unbelievable.
I say in that article that I interviewed the author, Dr. Barbara Starfield, of that article in the Journal of the American Medical Association. I interviewed her about a year or a year and a half before she died. And she confirmed, she said, this is a conservative estimate that I made. She said, other studies since then have pegged the death figure higher. And then she said that the federal government has done nothing about it. And they have done nothing. Nobody has approached her from the government to consult on this and to try to find solutions. And this was 2009, I believe, that I interviewed her. So this was 9 years after she had published her review. And then she herself had a heart condition of some kind, okay? Her husband is a physician. So one day she's swimming in the pool and she dies. And there's blood in the pool where she possibly, apparently, hit her head. She may have had a small stroke. And her husband writes an outraged letter to, I can't remember the name of the medical journal now. And he talks about the drug that she was on, Plavix. and how the studies misconstrued the efficacy and the safety of the drug. And how, when you read between the lines of his letter, it's clear that what he's saying is, look, this is one of the drugs she was talking about. This is one of the drugs that, through hook or by crook, gets approved by the FDA. And then people take it, and then this is what happens. And his own wife died from it. Or it contributed to her death. He's saying it possibly contributed to her death. And he goes into details about small lesions that were found in her brain or bleeding at different spots when an autopsy was done, because he demanded an autopsy. So he is suggesting the possibility that her death was hastened by this medical drug that she was taking. And she was the one who exposed the whole thing in the year 2000. So the population has to rise up on many fronts and overcome these trolls and so-called skeptics and idiots who pretend that they understand science and the media and the government and their doctors. Huh. And point the accusing finger.
Yeah.
And make that outrage, that moral outrage, so clear and apparent.
Yeah.
That right. Other people right. Begin to say, well, me too, me too, me too, me too. Mm. Same here, same here. So that this becomes something that spreads like wildfire. Unstoppable. That's what has to happen.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. And they need to stop looking at these doctors as pillars of society. I mean, you know, these people you mentioned here in the article, all these people are pushing these terrible prescription drugs and causing all this damage, but they're going home and having their dinner and looking at themselves in the mirror and smiling every night, you know? It's like they've got right. Two sets of moral standards, don't they? They know that this is causing harm, but they're still dishing it out, these doctors anyway, and they're going home and living with themselves. And that's sociopathic to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I couldn't do something like that if I knew it was harming so many people. If I handed out something and I knew someone died, I'd be like, what? You know, what?
Yeah,
really?
This
how,
is going to stop
know?
Right now. Exactly.
Yeah, they don't care.
I have had a couple of people years and years ago. These would be people who either had invented some alternative, let's call it an alternative medicine, or who knew of somebody who had. And these people would be approached by significant medical people associated with, say, institutes and so forth, who would say, look, I have a family member who has cancer or whatever, whatever, and I want to try, because I've been reading about, you know, your alternative medicine. I want to try it. And so, okay, sure. Why are these, you know, big-time medical people coming to these alternative people quietly and secretly? Because they know that what they've got doesn't work and it's very dangerous. But then they'll turn around and go right back to work prescribing the same dangerous drugs to patients that are not part of their own family. Mm-hmm. I mean, talk about sociopathic. That's, you know, that's a pretty good description.
Yeah. Yeah, 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 yeah. It's all right to blame it all on the education that they go through and everything and going through the medical schools and everything. But no, you know, you're a human being. You can make your own decisions. That is wrong.
Exactly.
Wrong, it, yeah. How can you do
yeah,
that?
That's right. It's not just a matter of their education, because there's enough information out there for anybody these days to find it and understand what's happening.
That's right, and so that's what you were saying before, for general people to do, to get on there, you know, get on there and start researching. And that's why, you know, your website, your information is helping so much, and why we're doing this, get it out on social media, get it out everywhere. And you being on George Norrie and these shows, you know, InfoWars, everything that you're on as well, are getting it out to millions. It's fantastic. Thing really exposing this now, I think more than ever. So it's kind of exciting and good news as well, even though it's depressing. I think
yes, I would say definitely.
Yeah, I think so. You know, looking back, yeah, definitely, and so great work. We will try and hook up again soon. JohnRappaport.wordpress.com and NoMoreFakeNews.com, put those links up. And we'll try and hook up again soon, 2018, next year. Seems unbelievable, but great to speak with you, John. And we will
you too, Adam.
On another podcast soon. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Adam. Always appreciate it.
Thanks. Okay. Thanks, John Rappaport. Wow, unbelievable. Incredible times. Stay safe, stay sane, and stay well. Look after yourself and your family.